Hello everyone and welcome to the latest episode of the Squawker Talker podcast. As you know, a different host on today. My name's Jake Entwistle and I'm joined by two chieftains of Squawker. We have the chief editor, Will Hall. How are you, Will?
Very good to be back.
Yeah, after 2 weeks preparing solely for this podcast, yeah. I heard.
Preparing for the League Cup special.
That were you. And we also then have the chief writer, Mohammed Butt. How are you, Mo?
I'm feeling very good, Jake. Feeling very good. Enjoyed the League Cup. Lots of action. Lots of good stuff to talk about.
There is plenty to talk about. And we've got some tasty listeners' questions to come in with that. Today, we're going to be talking about the standout stats from the Carabao Cup. Whilst looking ahead towards the Premier League with some matchups repeating themselves, we're also going to be doing a bit of a Squawker scout. Anyone that's on social will know exactly what that entails. And then finally, we're going to have a final word on some of the Super Saturday lineups and a bit on the odd Puskas Award. Without further ado, let's begin with the one place where we have to start, and that is Frank Lampard, the apprentice, beating the master. Man United have now lost their last five penalty shootouts in all competitions, with that incredible penalty shootout ending with poor Phil Jones. I mean, and it seemed everyone knew Phil Jones was going to miss that one.
But that was the crazy thing, though, isn't it? That United lost the last five, because that was a really good shootout. Like, until Phil Jones, everyone was taking really baller penalties. And I mean, you wonder, had Romero been in goal, who is better at penalties than Lee Grant, would United have won that? You
know? I don't think Lee Grant... he got a hands to a couple, the penalties, as you said, were so good.
Yeah, no, I mean, it was literally 15 penalties scored, and every single one of them was fantastic until Phil Jones, poor guy. And then Mourinho called him out afterwards, like, I knew it was going to happen. Like, what are you doing?
Exactly.
And the worst thing was he lumped Eric Bailly in there with him as well.
Like, I know, he hadn't even taken one. But before the penalty shootout, there was obviously a match that was played, but only 90 minutes, given the new Carabao Cup rules.
Love that rule.
How do we think Lampard made himself look as a manager in that Old Trafford game? Were Derby impressive, or was it Mourinho... Mourinho-ing Man United?
I mean, there's a bit of Mourinho-ing obviously going on, but first and foremost, I would say Lampard was very impressive. He looked impressive, first of all, looked like a manager, you know.
Tracksuit, though.
I suppose if you think about it, he's a bit too young to be a suit and tie manager, isn't he, really? And, you know, so it makes sense. He was good. He was very good. His team came out, it wasn't like he was doing some sort of tactical wizardry. He just came out with a very simple system. Everyone in their right places, and they played... It's really weird to say this, because obviously it's like, of course they did, but he brought his side to Old Trafford, played very simple, good attacking football with a 4-2-3-1, unleashed Mason Mount as a midfielder, had Harry Wilson come in off the flank, and it was just very simple football, but it was effectively done, and United had, I mean, I can't be able to say this, United had no answer to it. It wasn't like he was pulling out some hocus pocus, but he did very well, the team played well, he made decent subs. The players were motivated, as you'd expect, but they understood what their roles were, what they had to do. They weren't panicking. They didn't get panicked by anything United did. I mean, United didn't even do that much, but they weren't panicked. They went behind, you know, remember, and United could have won the game, had chances, and Derby didn't really get panicked. They carried on playing the game. In fact, they got better in the second half. They really stepped their game up. I was very impressed with Frank Lampard and the way he sort of took Mourinho to school, really. I mean, I know Mourinho's not doing that well right now.
Took him to school.
He really did.
Derby had 16 shots, Man United had 14, so they beat them in that regard. But the one thing that I thought was quite damning, really, on Man United's side was four shots on target, excluding, obviously, the penalties, from Man United at home to a championship side. And Lukaku and Martial had 9 between them and just 1 on target.
Yeah, and I think Lukaku was also being compared to Connor Salmon by the Derby fans.
Wow.
I think as much as we can say Derby were impressive, Man United have in recent weeks developed a habit of, I think, slamming the brakes on too early. They go a goal up and the rest of the match is just a focus on preserving that lead.
So do we think that people like Mount... And Wilson in that team sort of made them slam the brakes, because they're loanees from their toxic rivals. Mason Mount had more passes than any Man United midfielder. They were getting control of the game. Yeah. Was it their talent controlling it, or was it, as Will said, just Man United retreating too much within themselves?
I think I would point. It was both. I'm not saying that. I don't want to take anything away from Derby.
No.
I just think, yeah, I think the current climate at Man United lends itself to anxiety, results in more conservative tactics.
Mourinho is already a manager
who sort of favours conservative tactics.
Yeah, no, he is. This is the thing with Mourinho, right? It's like this, normally what his sides used to do when his Chelsea sides, over a decade ago now, which is how the last time he was relevant, they would get 2-0 up and then they would just sort of like chill. And not chill, but they'd retreat themselves and they'd put on the brake. And if they scored 3-4, that was great, fantastic. But basically 2-0 and that was fine. Let's chill out now. We can sit on the brake and hit them. What his team currently seems to do, what United seem to do currently, is go 1-0 up and think, right, okay, now we can chill. And the two problems with that is, well, first thing is the one goal lead is not secure enough to sit on it, really, like that. Because one goal, one mistake, and oh, suddenly you're in trouble. As what happened against Wolves, really, and again tonight. And the second thing is, he doesn't have the defensive solidity and defensive structure to sit on a lead at all. Even a two goal lead, I wouldn't be secure if United were trying to sit on one. It's Mourinho isn't even Mourinho anymore. That's the funniest thing. Everyone talks about, oh, Mourinho got Mourinho'd by a certain, but like, you know, Wolves did it, whatever. But Mourinho isn't even Mourinho. Like his teams aren't defensively solid. De Gea is amazing, and that's basically what it is that's keeping United relevant at the moment. I mean, I know Smalling and Lindelof have a sort of semi-functional partnership, but you know, it was
the cornerstone of any good defence. Well, I think, yeah, semi-functional.
Yeah, exactly. No, look, it was just. I don't want to take anything away from Derby because I think they totally, 100% deserved the win. Should have got the win in normal time, but for that amazing cross from Dalot and that header from Fellaini. They fully deserved the win, right? So don't want to take anything away from them because I thought, you know, they were great. But you know, there's definitely a lethargy at United. You know, they were 1-0 up and it becomes sort of like, well, if you get a second goal, it's cool. We'll just sort of, and it was too lackadaisical. Mm. It wasn't like a concept, but we have to get a second goal. And then we get a third goal. And this sort of hunger that top teams kind of have. Like, you look at Liverpool, and I know they lost them and got to them in a minute, but when they score a goal, they then try to score another goal. And it's never just enough to sit on one goal, you know, and that's just the problem.
I think, you know, one problem. Team they're not going to be able to rest on now is fresh from their 8 goals against Macclesfield. Wow. West Ham next up in the Premier League for Man United. And they've obviously, if we're looking at sort of the key players in that game, you've got Sanchez, who is 831 minutes without a Premier League goal.
He needs...
And then on the other side, you've got Arnautovic, who missed that 0-0 with Chelsea, and you think if he was playing and got those chances that Antonio got, maybe Chelsea, West Ham would have got 3 points from that game.
They would have done.
He's been directly involved in 4 of 6 Premier League goals for West Ham. How do we see this one going quickly on Saturday? Is this overarching Pogba-Mourinho rivalry going to take over, and can West Ham get another win at the London Stadium?
I mean, yeah, it's like I said, I've said many pods prior to the season starting, I said Mourinho's going to pick a fight with Pogba and get sacked before Christmas, and he's done it now. The fight was sort of brewing all pre-season. He's had little snippets, and he now has literally said, you know, the rumours came out, oh, he'd never be captain again. After the match, he said, yeah, I've taken the captaincy off him and vice captaincy off him, and it's my decision, I can do that. Like,
but then all he was asking was what was on his Instagram the other night. That was all it was.
Such a needless
confrontation. Is that really too much from a manager to ask, Will?
It's just such a confrontation. It's
or Mo.
I just think it's...
No, this is good because I'm bored of the talking about Mourinho versus Pogba.
Yeah, I think the fact that it has not got down to what they're asking on Instagram.
Yeah.
One person that I think will be interesting, and if Pogba fails to overcome, if he plays, obviously we don't know what's going to happen now, but one person that's in this new West Ham 4-1-4-1, Declan Rice has been plopped straight in front of the defence.
Yeah.
Looks really comfortable against Chelsea, was really impressive, I thought. But then you can't help, me personally, it's maybe extreme, but you can't help draw certain comparisons with the role Eric Dier plays for Spurs. Very utility, very safe.
Yeah, hybrid role.
And in front of the defence. So Declan Rice, 2.4 interceptions per 90 for West Ham, which is the second most in their team, which is impressive. But is there going to be 19 years old, is there anything more to come? Or should West Ham develop this sort of iron shield in front of their defence?
He's a defensive mentor. I think there's always more to come. Especially, as like you say, he's so stable defensively already and he's safe with the ball. I think what you can practice on now with him, and given that his manager is Pellegrini, this probably will be where he goes, is being more expansive with the ball. I mean, Pellegrini is the guy, I remember, had Santi Cazorla in his team, had Isco in his team at Malaga. You know, he knows that the best way to have a midfielder, and Bruno Soriano at Villarreal, which is a great example for Declan Rice, actually. You look at Marcos Senna at Villarreal, another great example. See, this is what I'm saying. This is the kind of midfielder that Pellegrini likes. This is why I feel good for Declan Rice, because he has a solid base. He's a good, solid defender, keeps the ball very nice, neat and tidy. Now he can grow from that into an expansive passer, and then he becomes a really different player. And I think he's going to be a big problem for United. It's going to be interesting, though, how he handles Jesse Lingard, because against Chelsea, obviously, he handled them mostly fairly well, but Pedro wasn't playing in that game. I think Pedro is a really interesting prospect to try and handle as a defensive mid and as a fullback. And he's a defensive mid, not a fullback, but handling Pedro's off-the-ball movement is tricky. How he handles Jesse Lingard's off-the-ball movement is going to be tricky, because I think he'll handle Pogba pretty well face up. Unless Pogba has an amazing game, which, given what he's going through with Mourinho, I'd be surprised if he does. But handling Lingard is going to be very important, because Lingard is often the key to unlocking the whole United attack. Like, even the goal against Derby, was the first goal was because Lingard made a great little bit of a great
slick,
little run.
Yeah, and it was a slick move.
Yeah, it was a really good move, and it was unlocked by Lingard. So I wonder how Rice handles the off ball movement of Lingard. Otherwise, I think he's going to play very well.
Any thoughts on
Declan Rice situation? Absolutely, I think there's more to come from him. I know that West Ham see it that way. There's the contract situation ongoing at the moment, during the coverage of which they've briefed that they think the world of him. Everyone's impressed by his willingness to learn behind the scenes at the club. West Ham more broadly, I think that's three positive results for them. With the Everton win, the draw against Chelsea, and then their record-breaking 8-0 thrashing of Macclesfield, which is obviously, you've noted in the running order, their biggest since like the mid-80s.
Yeah, 1983.
Also, Macclesfield's heaviest defeat as a as a league, English Football League club.
Wow. as a weird bit of trivia.
So as much as you as much as you can say that, it's just Macclesfield. It's unprecedented.
Yeah, as a weird bit of trivia, just before we leave this subject, Villarreal, Manuel Pellegrini, the club he got famous managing in Europe, has a population that's the same size as Macclesfield, and he took Villarreal to the Champions League semi-finals.
So
next time on.
So yeah, like I say, three positive results, and they're also coming up against a Man United side that are not in good shape.
Best time
at the
to
moment.
Play them.
Exactly. So if they can then sort of consolidate this streak with a scalp, I mean, it's a kind of as much as you can say beating Man United is a scalp in this current moment.
That completes the set.
That cements the sort of corner turn they've made under Pellegrini.
Under Pellegrini
in recent weeks.
And a couple of players that are starting to look good for those. But we'll move on from West Ham and United. And obviously, the other big game on Saturday, but one that we've already seen a preview of, was Liverpool versus Chelsea. And Eden Hazard decided to decide that game on his own.
Literally.
With the stunning solo goal. And he's now got 6 career goals against Liverpool. One was for Lille, which was quite surprising. And 4 of them have come at Anfield. So in that game, obviously, it was a star player that came on the pitch and won the game for Chelsea, but the starting 11s were very much fringe-focused. So which fringe players did actually impress in that game and have potential to be in the starting 11 for Saturday? Or is it going to be a complete reshuffle, and is Klopp going to revert back to that midfield that no one thought was going to be their first choice but has proven to be very good?
So it's very difficult to put the fringe label on many Liverpool midfielders at the moment. I mean, Keita didn't start the last game, for instance. He played very well last night, came into the League Cup as one of the 8 changes I think they made. I don't really see any of them breaking into the lineup. Fabinho obviously made his debut and was the focus for much of the analysis. It was kind of it was the biggest point of intrigue going into that game.
He made a team high 4 tackles.
Yeah, but I think from his performance on the whole revealed just why Klopp's not thrown him into the starting 11 yet. He looks like he might need a little bit more time. Sturridge scores his 11th goal in 11 League Cup games, I think.
Yeah.
But we knew he was in good form already, and still he's not in the starting 11 because that front three is so solid. Yeah. I think against Chelsea it will go back to Wijnaldum, who is the first name on the team sheet, it seems, at the moment. Henderson or Milner is an interesting point because he obviously started Milner.
Yeah, but when Henderson came on...
I said to Mo before this, I think we'll probably get into a bit of a debate. So I found the criticism of Henderson pretty strange. I know he did...
I think he was the first player Eden Hazard did in the build-up to his goal, but then again, he did half the Liverpool team. And
that's very true.
I think it was essentially the moment that he fouled Hazard on the edge of the box and then shouted at him that became a sort of image for his, summing up his performance as a whole. I think people kind of jumped on that moment and was like, oh, Hazard's rattled Henderson. When in actual fact, I think the tempo was kind of upped when he came on a little bit, and if you, judging by his sort of performance on the whole, it wasn't that bad. It was just that sort of moment where he let Hazard dribble past him in midfield.
I just think the thing with Henderson was, I think when he came on, obviously because he's a better forward passer than Milner, so the, like you said, the tempo got a bit picked up. But I just think without Milner, it wasn't so much that Henderson came on, it wasn't the fact that Milner went off. I think they lost the sort of, there's a real solidity James Milner brings to the season.
I wouldn't say that, because Liverpool's worst period of the game was the first 30 minutes when Fabregas was running things.
Yeah.
Which is really odd.
Well, I mean, I think the sort of pace of the game at that point suited Fabregas. He wasn't being pressed very much. It was only when Sadio Mane decided to sort of...
It's hard to lead a press, I think, when you don't have your... Because the thing with Liverpool's press is it comes from Firmino. That's the start of it. Or Firmino, then Salah and Mane joining.
Well, yeah, which is why it was good to see Sadio Mane kind of instigate that. After the first 30 minutes.
He was like, okay, well, no, you're not going to do it. I'm going to do it. Because Sturridge and Shaqiri aren't like... Even if... I think they could adapt to it. Well, Shaqiri probably could. I don't know about Sturridge, but... Even if they could adapt to it, they're not going to do it so quickly. I thought Fabinho was actually all right. I do agree with what was said, that there's clear that why he's not in the team.
Yeah,
I would. What I thought was this really cool little moment, I thought, right before Hazard scored his goal, where he tried to run through the middle of the pitch, and instead of just knocking him down and fouling him like Henderson or basically every other Liverpool player did, Fabinho really caught calmly, just sort of shuttled him out wide. And it was a really sort of subtle bit of play, but I thought that's what he can do once he adapts to the rest of the game, because obviously that he's not there yet, but once he adapts the rest of his game to Klopp's style of football, I think once he can, that's what he can bring, just this really sort of smart, physical defensive midfield player. He could have knocked Hazard to the ground and fouled him easily, but he shuttled him out wide. Of course, then Hazard ran back in and did Moreno three times.
I was going to say, when you're shoveling out wide to Alberto Moreno as your fullback...
Yeah, exactly. You're doing more harm than good there.
I think that was one of the big takeaways that I saw in terms of analysis was the apparent gulf now between Liverpool's first choice fullbacks.
Exactly, yeah.
And who comes in to replace them.
Because Klein was okay, but you could see that... What he lacks that Trent brings is that he's not as much of a front foot player, and his passing when he gets into the final third isn't as great. And Moreno, as you say, almost looked complicit in the goal in that he ran across Hazard. It was like a sort of set piece routine where one player runs over the ball rather than
It was shocking, again, you don't take anything away from an attacker. You never want to take anything away from an attacker, but that was shocking defending from Moreno.
Well, it's Hazard identifying, right, I can turn it up now and absolutely roast this guy.
It's like, right, this guy's a weakness, and then and Mignolet, I mean, probably couldn't do anything about the shot, but it was a wonderful goal. I would never want to take anything away from Eden Hazard for that. But it was just terrible defending from Moreno.
I think with that fullbacks thing as well is the reason Alexander-Arnold and Milner on that right-hand side work so well.
I know exactly what you're about to say.
Because the Alexander-Arnold can become a centre midfielder, and then Milner's like, oh yeah, I'll just go back to being my 16-year-old right winger that broke onto the scene. So again, it's all about, I think that goes underrated, is the partnerships that build up and understanding.
It's a symbiotic side. It's not symmetrical, it's asymmetrical, and it works as everyone sort of develops an understanding. It's basically what happened at Dortmund. You know, the way his Dortmund team was built was kind of asymmetrical and developed a lot of little partnerships on the field, and that really is what made things amazing. And I think Liverpool is very much developing the same. And once he figures out where Keita fits in exactly into that midfield, we'll start seeing more of him. Fabinho, same thing. I mean, once he has the one issue they're going to have is going forward is how can you replace Milner, because you can see Gini Wijnaldum dropping out and Fabinho coming in as a one for one thing with an upgrade if Fabinho gets adapted, and Keita obviously is better than any midfielder they have, so once he gets adapted, fine. The thing with Milner is who can, because it's like you said, Milner covers Alexander-Arnold and allows Alexander-Arnold to be the guy that he is, so you wonder how. I mean, Milner's super fit, so maybe I'm...
But that's what I mean. I think it's easy to... We all say, oh, when will they replace Milner? But they might just leave him in.
It was supposed to happen 2 seasons ago,
exactly.
Really, wasn't it, when he was...
So he deserves credit. And then just moving on now to the Premier League tie, which will be at Stamford Bridge. And something which I found quite surprising was Chelsea have only actually won 2 of the last 8 games. at Stamford Bridge between Liverpool and Chelsea. They've lost four and drawn two and won two.
It's not that surprising when you think about. I mean, Mourinho was there. They were terrible. Mourinho was there before they were terrible. You know, and it, Conte obviously had his horrible. They've had like two genuinely terrible years in the last 4 years. So it's like it's sort of like you can see how that sort of stat could build up. I think it's really interesting at the weekend because it's going to be a completely different game because as much as Fabregas did well for 30 minutes, he kind of tailed off after that. There without Jorginho. It's Chelsea are complete. Forget Hazard. I mean, Hazard obviously is the best player, right? But in terms of like the way Chelsea play, the guy who knows how to play the system is Jorginho. And the one guy who really emerged from West Ham with credit was Jorginho. I mean, not just because he made 180 passes, because he made all the key passes. He made all the good passes, the penetrative ones. I think bringing him back in against that midfield, Liverpool midfield, is going to be really interesting.
I think Firmino will almost man mark Jorginho rather than anyone else.
But that's going to be interesting because then David Luiz, who I thought was also really good for Chelsea when he came on, really stabilised the defence. Because then he's going to have more freedom to play. And I think that's going to be the interesting quandary for Liverpool is how do you deal with those two being the playmakers for Chelsea? Now, obviously, then the issue is once they get to the forwards, then Hazard's going to be there. Is Pedro going to be fit? I don't think he is.
I'm not sure. It was an arm injury.
They'll have Giroud, so that would be thing. Hazard will probably get a lot more looks at goal because Giroud will be a brilliant target man for him. But how Liverpool deal with David Luiz and Jorginho is going to be interesting. I like the idea for Firmino just sort of marking Jorginho, but then I think you lose something because then David Luiz can just basically step into midfield and be Jorginho. I mean, it won't be as good, but. Mm. How they deal with that? How Firmino and
Sarri would want you to press man for man for man.
Yeah, that's
the whole point. His patterns of play would unpick that. So it's which player do Liverpool target the most with that press? When do they initiate the press? I think will be the key sort of feature in the first 30 minutes.
I think they'll go for Kante. I think that's what if they're smart, they'll really hammer Kante when he's in possession because he gives the ball away a lot.
So let's just get a little prediction. Obviously. Yeah. Hazard decides the Carabao Cup at Anfield, but the Premier League important one, obviously, Liverpool is still 100%. So will Chelsea take that off them at Stamford Bridge?
Take the 100% record?
I think I've given you a way out there. You can say two results.
I think it'll be a draw. I think 1-1, and I think Giroud will score.
Ooh.
Because this is two players actually in the lineup that Liverpool don't like playing. With Hazard obviously having scored six goals,
which is
more than against any other top six side.
Yeah, but not many of them are at Stamford. One is at Stamford.
Oh, okay, yeah. And then you've got Giroud, who I think has got five goals in his last seven appearances.
As an Arsenal fan, I remember him some good evenings of his performances. But what's funny as well is Van Dijk going to be fit for that game? Do we know?
Yeah. So immediately after the. He came off against Southampton. Klopp said it's a rib injury, which they kind of knew about before kickoff. I think he had a bruise on his ribs before even the PSG game. But he did play it down and said it's not too serious. So I would imagine that his absence from the game last night was more a case of resting him rather than having to drop him.
As Troy Deeney recently said about Van Dijk being too strong, too handsome, too good smelling, he's going to come up against.
That's going to be
one. Beautiful centre-back versus striker battle that we're going to see.
The handsomest one-on-one duel this weekend.
Possibly the handsomest combination in the Premier League.
That's the groundbreaking stuff that we discover and work out on the Squawker Talker podcast. So moving beyond the sort of big-name teams that are left in the Carabao Cup, there are still some other good little tasty Premier League sides in there. And one question that we had in from a listener, D3, D4 Football, was, given the dominance of the usual top six, which side outside the traditional group can you see breaking through and challenging on a regular basis over the next 4 to 5 years? And I wanted to put this in with almost a... Maybe if they don't break into the top six this season, can they become a Carabao Cup winner? And the teams I've identified are Fulham, which is obviously quite a rogue place to start given their shaky start, but they've only had one clean sheet this season. But they're scoring quite a few goals, and there's goals in the game. With someone like Mitrovic up front, can they make a Carabao Cup run? And also, as a side question to think about, will they just be prioritising relegation, and can they actually stay up?
I think they're a really proactive side. They've got a lot of ambition. I think they'll try and compete on two fronts. I wouldn't be surprised if they did. Whether or not their squad can handle competing on two fronts, I mean, we'll find out, I guess. But if they go for a Carabao Cup run, they've got the talent to do it. You know, scoring goals is always a big difference in cup games. As for breaking into the top six, I think that's a bit beyond them right now. Yeah. But you know, the way Djokovic has them playing, they're really attractive side with a really good philosophy. In Seri, they've signed a Champions League quality player. So Mitrovic obviously has always had this sort of top four potential. He just never seemed to come good at Newcastle.
Well, he's still only 24 as
well. This is the thing. Bizarre. I mean, he's had so many years of being a flop. Everyone's like, but you know, he's a young striker, and he's well, maybe now he's not, because 24 really is when you pass the idea of being young, but he's a phenomenal talent, and it's funny that we all forget that because of how long he's been terrible for Newcastle. But when they signed him, it was like, oh my god, they've got Mitrovic. This is serious business. This guy's got a really huge ceiling of talent, and he's doing really well now for Djokovic. So
he's actually had, only Aguero's had more shots in the Premier League.
He's not an efficient striker.
The fact that a newly promoted striker is getting the second most shots in the league.
I mean, that's the system,
I think it deserves. Yeah. Fulham deserve credit for giving him that many chances, and he deserves credit
for
lot of them are headers as well. Yeah. So you can't just, whereas some people criticise Ronaldo and Kane for just whacking it from 25 yards every 5 seconds, Mitrovic is. You can't just tee yourself up for a header on the edge of the box and get it towards goal. They're creating chances for him.
Mm. I think previous comparisons to Edinson Cavani from Mo have been forthcoming as well, judging based on his movement. But obviously,
I think that's
facetious. But I think that's his standout attribute, is his movement.
Yeah, I'm really impressed with him. And every time he plays for Serbia as well, you see he's a good striker, and he's the perfect counterbalance to Fulham's patient, pretty style of play. And I think that's what got them promoted last season, is all of a sudden they brought in a striker that could throw some elbows.
Yeah, well, and that's the thing, is that he can play on, it's like Cavani, like the Cavani thing is right on, because he can play on the ground with their pretty style of football, but then also he can hit it in the air. So if you need to, like, ping, ping, ping on the ground, la, 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 oh, you need to cross it too, and he can deal with that.
What about Phil Neville's Diego Costa comparisons? Is that a similar thing, or is that just because they're
I think it's just that's temperament.
Yeah.
And Costa as well is a striker who demonstrated a really effective blend of physicality and savvy movement. I think that's fair. But these are both players who Mitrovic needs to sort of really step up to if he to justify those comparisons.
So he's on 5 goals for Golden Boot. What do we think his likely goal tally will be Premier League wise? If he's got 5 after 6
he
games.
He's 5 already. I would say high teens, maybe even over 20. Honestly, I think if Seri and the key Fulham playmakers, mainly Seri, stay fit, high teens over 20s. If they don't, if there's injuries, then maybe just maybe like 15, 16, something like that. But I think if the Fulham players stay fit, the key Fulham players stay fit, absolutely over 20, I think, 100%.
All right, and moving on to just another interesting Premier League team that's probably, I think, everyone's picked to be the closest right now. Leicester are through in the Carabao Cup. They won on penalties against Wolves, who, surprisingly, under Espirito Santo, have not conceded in normal time in the League Cup yet. But they're out in the third round. 6 games, no goals conceded, and 2 penalty shootout defeats, which is quite surprising. But Leicester, going back to them, they're obviously through. Claude Puel obviously got Southampton to that final recently. James Maddison looks incredible. I think it's hard not to get excited about him. Iheanacho has found a role. Vardy's back from his ban. Are Leicester the best place to do it, and how far could they go in this cup competition?
You've seen before Southampton, they got to the final and knocked out Liverpool on the way. So, you know, as Puel can do anything, as long as, again, it's all the thing with these small suitors. Pardon me. This thing with these small sides is, as long as they stay fit, the players stay fit, because they haven't got the big squads that the big clubs have. If they can keep the key guys fit, they can keep Maddison fit. Anything's possible. You know, Puel is always a fantastic, organised coach. I still can't get over the fact that Southampton sacked him. It's the weirdest thing. But their loss is Leicester's game. Leicester have built, they've got a very, very good squad. Maddison is a phenomenal talent, as you say. They've got Vardy back, and that's really important. I think they'll build a solid defence, and they'll get to the final off well, not the final, but I think they can definitely get semi-finals at least. I mean, and then who knows? It depends who you draw. But yeah, I wouldn't rule them out at all. I think they've got a really, really good team, and they've got a really good coach who understands tactics, basically understands how to set up tactically to nullify an opponent and also maximise your own strengths on
so
the break.
So just briefing on Wolves, obviously we can't predict how far they're going to go in the cup because they're out, but Will, in the question, Wolves were highlighted as probably the most ambitious out of these chasing top six pack. Are people getting ahead of themselves a bit, or is there a clear path and a clear pool of talent to push that group?
If you look at the sheer quantity of signings they made during the summer, they along with Fulham, I mean, basically not doubled the size of their squads, but they bought a new lineup essentially. Coming back to the question of whether people are getting ahead of themselves, I think they objectively are. When people like Phil Neville says they're the greatest promoted side in Premier League history
after six games,
yeah, but I mean, I think everyone's just responding to the fact that we've seen something in them, like a really good sort of mentality, some actual genuine talent and technical ability in players such as Neves and Jota. They're just responding to that.
And the fastest player on FIFA 19, Adama Traore.
Yeah.
Yet to be fully unleashed. He did miss a penalty there.
That's scary, though, if they can get him unleashed. He's such a scary talent.
He came on against Manchester United and I think took more shots than any other player. Yeah. Took three. All of which you could... Maybe two of which you could make a case that he should have laid it off.
It's the Adama conundrum, isn't it?
But it's exactly, he just showed both sides of his games. And all three shots he sort of created for himself by dribbling through people. I know we've kind of gone on a bit of a tangent here by just talking about...
No, it's interesting. It's like the fact that Wolves have those sort of players, maybe being out the League Cup is actually bad because they look like they're going to be safe.
I think as well that like a cup run... is what those kind of teams should be looking to include in a season to make it a successful one. I don't think mid-table finishes are really that inspiring.
Exactly. And the thing is, just quickly touching on why I just believe they won't be relegated and why a cup run would have been great, is Cardiff and Huddersfield have actually conceded more goals than they've had shots on target in the Premier League this season. 14 goals conceded, 13 shots on target, and they're both struggling. So it looks like there's one place up for grabs in relegation, and Wolves certainly don't look like they're going to be there. So I think, as I said, they haven't even conceded a goal in the League Cup. So I think they will be gutted. But yeah, Leicester, again, they're a sort of team that's very well placed, I think, to prioritise mid-table. I think Claude Puel would rather finish 11th than get in a final or with a chance of winning it rather than just finish 7th.
Didn't he? He understands the value of winning a cup, which is something that a certain Argentine manager in North London should probably take notice of.
Well, Spurs got through on penalties in Stadium NK.
I know, and I think that the League Cup doesn't... I mean, Wenger said a few years ago, in 2010, that the League Cup won't end Arsenal's trophy drought. And I do think that's just reflective of... It's not going to do much for Pochettino. I think it will end the... Oh, it hasn't won a trophy trope, but...
It's a lose-lose if you win it.
I think the glaring caveat, by the way, with all these sort of predictions and talking about dark horses, is that they kind of, I think they didn't move, they've moved the draw to like Saturday, but in reference to previous seasons. So we kind of don't know
who each team's going
to draw, and that is going to have a major influence because West Ham obviously drew Macclesfield, Liverpool drew Chelsea, and you would have tipped Liverpool to go further than West Ham at the start of the season.
It's a very good point. So that's ruined all of that last bit that I prepared. Despite the fact that you said it doesn't make any sense, I just did want to talk about Bournemouth quickly, really briefly. 29 goals in 8 games so far this season. Not they've scored, that's just in their game. Are they just too volatile to do anything substantial? Because I think that's what you get when you watch them is... They've got a brilliant counter-attacking team now.
I think, yeah, volatility is a quality that sort of characterised the complexions of most of their games, but so has spirit when you look at how many games they come back from.
Yeah.
So I think that the reason there's been so many goals is because they're carrying out so many comeback wins.
Yeah, but that's what I mean. Is that a sustainable philosophy to be like, it's not we're going to get to the cup final by just always coming back?
based on common sense, it's not, but they have sustained a really good record for comebacks. So I don't have it to hand, but I think it's up
I remember them being high up on points won from losing positions.
I think only Man United were more points from behind than they did last season. Look, they are a very spirited side. They're tactically, you know, open, adventurous, whatever. Yes, they sustain. They constantly have these comeback wins, and fair enough. But the problem is, to really sort of mount a massive cup run or a league run to get high up in the league, you have to actually be stable, and they're not stable. And so, for every one comeback they have, they lose two games. You know what I mean?
They lost 4-0 to Burnley.
Well, yeah, exactly. So it's just like Eddie Howe is fast becoming a real enigma of a coach. Like, he looked really amazing, promising when he brought Bournemouth up, and he still looks promising, but it's just, I think
as the seasons go by, he's becoming less and less flavour of the month. So
he's clearly,
I think that's
talent.
Good for him though.
No, it's good for him.
I think Bournemouth have quietly built quite a good Ryan Fraser looks great. They've got Josh King and Callum Wilson,
he develops talent
who
very
work
well.
In tandem very well, and David Brooks has come in.
Nathan
Lewis Cook
is fantastic. He develops talent excellently. I think one thing, if Pochettino ever does take that leap to go to Real Madrid, if I was Levy, I would look at Eddie Howe, because I think Eddie Howe very much would fit very neatly into the way Spurs do things. I mean, a bit more buccaneer and brazen than Poch is, but in terms of developing young talent and working with young talent, I think he's fantastic. I think that's going to stand him in good stead for his next job, whatever that is. But
Eddie Howe will now lead Spurs into the Stadium MK era.
I mean, you heard it here first. I'm just annoyed that they're playing Barcelona at Wembley and not at the Stadium MK. I would love to see Messi and Milton Keynes.
That would have been great.
That would have been amazing.
Talking about Eddie Howe developing young talent, I think it's worth... The Carabao Cup is always famous for 12-year-olds making their debut.
Arsene Wenger.
Exactly. So in this little Squawk Us Out section, I wanted both of you to sort of pick out a player that caught your eye that was obviously a breakout star. One player that I just want to say first up that I don't think anyone knows much about is the first 2003-born player to play in English football. Fulham gave a debut to Harvey Elliott in their 3-1 victory, which just made everyone feel really, really old, I think.
Yeah.
So obviously players like him being given a chance, Jokanović said he's a bit arrogant, but it's a good arrogance. So he's definitely a name to keep on your radar, because that's the qualities of a successful football player, in my opinion. But Mo, we'll start with you. Who was the player that you'd like to squawk a scout from the Carabao Cup?
It's really boring, but Mason Mount, it's such an obvious thing to say, but he was so good at Old Trafford. And not in a sort of obviously, this guy's amazing, he scored 4 goals and he got an assist. No, he didn't score, he didn't even get an assist, but he played so well, so intelligently. And, he made, and this is the thing, I've been a big critic of Nemanja Matic for a long time, and everyone's always said, what are you talking about? I was like, well, look what Mason Mount did to him, and that's kind of what I'm talking about. Mount was fantastic at Old Trafford, ran rings around Matic. His use of the ball was really intelligent. He didn't really waste it too much. I mean, he completed 35 of 48 passes, one of them was a key pass. He had 65 touches. It was like watching Lampard when Lampard was not that age, but like 23. It was like watching a young Frank Lampard. It really was, with a bit more mobility, because Lampard was never that quick or agile.
Perpetual Lampard.
Yeah, it was just, the way that he knew where to stand. He always knew where to stand. He was never afraid to be at that, to offer himself for a pass. He was never afraid to sort of drive his team forward. And I mean, the whole Derby side was not afraid, right? But he was just the heart of it. Everything went through him. He took set pieces, not all of them, obviously. Harry Wilson, shout out. But
it was those two standing over him.
Yeah,
that
it
I quite
was those
liked.
Two. And he was not afraid. And he scored at the weekend. Of course, he scored a free kick. He's not afraid to sort of take charge of a situation, which his edge is incredible. The fact that you walk into Old Trafford at that, how is it, 19?
Yep.
So you walk into Old Trafford at 19 years old and you're playing for Derby, right? You're not like playing for Barcelona or Real Madrid or whatever, or Bayern Munich. You're playing for Derby and you walk in and you own the place. You own the place. And that's just incredible. Ander Herrera, playing against him. Ander Herrera's once marked Eden Hazard out of a game. Couldn't get near Mason Mount. Yeah, it's just a really, really impressive performance by a player who, frankly, I'm baffled isn't already competing for places at Chelsea. Like, you're looking at how good he is, but probably for his development, this is better.
On that quick front. Sarri, new manager in, yeah. Mason Mount, first season in senior football was at Vitesse. That's a risk to beat for Sarri.
Yeah. It's probably his.
I think if you look at what's happened to Loftus-Cheek in terms of wanting to stay and believing he had the talent to fight for it, Mason Mount would have been quite low down in that pecking order. Yeah.
That's what I'm saying.
And now he's just, as I said, he's been given the opportunity to turn heads at Old Trafford and he took it.
And I really, really hope that Chelsea play him next season. And by playing, I mean they start him. I really, because this kid, I think within a year, I think he's going to be. He's so good. He's so talented. I mean, he's so intelligent.
Biting your tongue about a hot take there, weren't you? I could see it. Where does he play in this Chelsea team in the future? Under Sarri?
In the hamstring role. I think
So where Kovacic?
Yeah, where Kovacic is playing right now. I mean, he's not the shuttler. He can do it, but you don't want him being the shuttler box to box guy. That's not. And obviously, he's not replacing Jorginho at the base of midfield. I think he's very much in the hamstring role. I think he would thrive
in
that
role.
He's
a goal scorer.
Yeah, he scores goals. He's way more. Well. I don't want to say way more, but statistically, he's more of a goal threat than Kovacic.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
I think that was the one thing.
And that's the attribute Kovacic really lacks to play that hamstring role.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. I think
Hamstring's Napoli's record goal scorer. So,
what you're saying is Mason Mount will break Frank Lampard's Chelsea all-time top scoring record. I'm just putting words in.
You know what? You know what?
Mo's not afraid to say that.
You know what? Slowly backed away from the mic.
Yeah, you know what? 27 September 2018, I'm saying it. Mason Mount's going to break Frank Lampard's goal scoring record.
What was the date?
27 September 2018.
We'll have to get a move on, Mason. So, obviously, you can't pick Chelsea's future top scorer.
I thought this was an incredible round for young talent, so I might actually rattle off a few. Harry Wilson, knuckleball free kick was insane. There's also West Ham lad Diangana.
I think that's
two Diangana, two goals and assist. He's not really like stand out in terms of an unknown quantity, but Phil Foden, a word on him. Carl Robinson said after that game that they had a game plan to really press Man City, which Foden tore up in the first 20 seconds with one turn when two Oxford midfielders tried to close him down. Then after the game gets compared to Andres Iniesta by Guardiola, despite Guardiola saying, I won't compare him to Iniesta, but... so Phil Foden's another one. Derby centre-back, someone might have to remind me his name.
Tomori,
yeah. Bailed Richard Keogh out in the first 20 minutes with the tackle. Maybe was that the one that was called for a penalty on? But regardless, he demonstrated his pace and got back. Yeah. And for the rest of the game, as we've said previously, Lukaku didn't get much of a look in there.
I think it was. You're right to highlight plenty of young talents that were on the show. Emil Smith Rowe made his full debut for Arsenal as well. Brentford as well have a. It was a bit annoying to see them not play a weakened side, but they've got some very exciting young players, and not all of them got the chance to make a go of it at the Emirates, which Arsenal, I think, at the moment look beatable by anyone. But they also scoring goals with Danny Welbeck.
Yeah, just also to bookend this section on the League Cup, which I think we're about to conclude.
Yeah, yeah.
Can you see the future
on Derby is that this win's good timing for them because they've just recorded a big-ish result against Brentford, which took them up the league spots. I think they've got Norwich and Bolton next, but then after that they've got Sheffield United, West Brom and I think Borough, who are all three of whom are above them. So I think it's a good idea to really keep an eye on this Lampard team and see how they cope over the fixture list.
There's plenty of exciting talents and reasons why. So
yeah,
everyone's a Derby fan now.
Also, actually, Jody Morris, we should shout out because it can be no it can be no coincidence that these young players are thriving.
I almost thought when they hired Lampard and Morris that it should have been the other way around. Jody Morris, I think he enjoys that not anonymity. A backseat role is an unfair way to put it, but he. Behind the scenes, working magic, and Lampard is that Derby hired Lampard to be a face and make everyone look at Derby.
Yeah, and this is the thing: if Frank Lampard's an assistant manager, right, it's hard for him to say, "Hey, come to Chelsea," and you're like, "Oh my god, yeah." Because I mean, not to disrespect Morris's reputation, but if you say, "Do you want to play for Jody Morris or do you want to play for Frank Lampard?" Frank Lampard is like, "Wow!" Yeah. And if they do go up, into the Premier League, and if they do actually become a halfway decent side, then suddenly playing for Frank Lampard, it's like Frank Lampard's like a legend. And Jody Morris, like you said, he's a youth coach. Loved being a youth coach. He can just work away, do his brilliant stuff behind the scenes. I think
at one point he needs to become a manager because he's.
I think it's generally assumed that that's the career path in mind for everyone, but I don't know if it's necessarily always the case. Like, you get a lot of coaches who are happy to
being a great coach. Well, I mean,
Guti has said that he prefers coaching young players, like Real Madrid, for instance. I mean, he's a legend, so he's said I'd rather prefer coaching young players.
So maybe Lampard and Morris is the managerial duo to watch out for in the future. Mm. So, as promised, a new bit of Super Saturday preview. We've covered some of the games that are going to be on there, but around Europe on Saturday, I think because of the Champions League restarting again, no one's playing on Sunday. Basically. Everyone's playing on Saturday. And we'll go first to Serie A. There's two games which caught my eye straight away. At 2:00, you've got Roma versus Lazio. And Roma are actually 8th at the moment, with Lazio in 3rd. And following that, you have 1st versus 2nd, Juventus versus Napoli, the could-be Ronaldo derby.
So De Laurentiis, who is probably the most outspoken owner of an Italian club, Serie A, claims that Ronaldo was offered to Napoli during the summer. So it's kind of a sliding doors
before Juventus
comment. Sort of before Juventus, yeah.
I mean, which does. I mean, yeah. It sounds like him just bragging. But honestly, if you look at it, that Napoli have bought Higuain and Callejon from Real Madrid, so it kind of that wouldn't surprise me if they did offer him because they know that they've got good dealings with Juventus. They know he pays up and all that sort of stuff. I would like to have seen him go Napoli just because romantically that would have been beautiful. Him in San Paolo, south of Italy. It's a really nice kit. He would look great in it.
Their kits have been. As someone that follows kits closely, they've got very rogue designs this year, and I don't think they're as romantic as they used to be. So maybe it was right that he chose the black and white of the old lady.
It's a very classy black and white look. But also, imagine the stadium announcement at San Paolo going crazy for Ronaldo scoring goals. And I mean, he would have given them the firepower to go over Juventus, really. And of course, Ancelotti is the manager there. He loves Ancelotti. That's the main, would have been the main attraction for
him. That's the sort of main question. It's Roma Lazio. Yeah. That's an odd one, seeing Roma so far down. And I saw rumours that Di Francesco was going to be sacked.
I think
yes. Do you know who's been linked with replacing him?
Who was it? I remember seeing a name.
It is one Sir Claudio Ranieri.
I would not bet against Lazio in that game. They've lost to Juventus and Napoli opening 2 games of the season. They've won every game since. Immobile is rocking.
Still scoring. Yeah.
They've got Joaquin Correa, who is just a really, really good player. I still don't understand why Sevilla sold him. I think he's going to be really interesting to watch. Kind of their replacement for Felipe Anderson. I think I would bet on Lazio in that game.
Savic is sort of going back under the radar despite being linked with £150 million moves. But he got a goal and assist in his last game. But Roma have a great squad. That should be... This is why it's odd, is because you've still got Dzeko.
They make so many signings. They made so many. The turnover this last summer and the one before has been substantial.
So I think they're going to... They will come good. I think it's been just a poor start.
You saw so many of the ones they signed the season before that you thought, oh, like Gonalons was the one I was really interested in. Very high tackle stats and looked like a kind of interesting defensive midfielder went there. I think sustained an injury and then left straight away.
Losing Strootman and Nainggolan kind of sucked the life out of their team, basically. And
wouldn't have sold them if they believed that strongly. They were both... Strootman injury prone.
They will replace
Nainggolan, a maverick.
Like you said, it'll take time.
Yeah,
they will replace, and the guys they've signed, they'll build again. Monchi doesn't make mistakes like this, but it will take time. The players have to adapt.
They've got Cengizunda and Kluivert as like.
Yeah, Cengizunda's first goal of the season was it recently?
Yeah,
it was a bit of a worldie.
For now, I think Lazio will have it, and I think Juve Napoli would be a really. As much as it'd be nice for Napoli to win, I love it. They've got Fabian Luiz, fantastic little player from Betis. They've got Adama Diawara, who I love. Amadou Diawara, who I love. Defensive midfielder. They're the replacement for Jorginho. He's a fantastic defensive midfielder. So smart.
Do we think Napoli will be...
I think
challenging Juventus all the way because it's first, second at the moment, but it's already 3 points. And
Ancelotti doesn't.
I don't think Napoli looked that convincing.
They haven't been. And Ancelotti doesn't do leagues anyway. Yeah.
Was it Insigne or Callejon who said Ancelotti's came and he's not really changed much? So you wonder if they're kind of run out of smoke, out of fumes a bit as the season goes on, when there's no more fresh ideas coming out.
The one thing that is quite nice is seeing Milik play up front and scoring a few goals.
Yeah, it's good for him. He had a really rough time.
He does
his cruciate ligament every season, I think. So one of the Ajax sort of talents that deserved his big move is now getting a bit of a foothold, and we might see him near the top of goal scoring charts. So Serie A definitely won. Those two games would be definitely watchable. Juventus especially looking to keep their 100% record. But moving over to Ronaldo's old stomping ground, La Liga, which had quite the night whilst Carabao Cup was going on. Real Madrid, obviously Atletico, is the game that I'm focusing on. But Leganés, first time they've ever beaten Barcelona. They were 20th place, Barcelona were first place when that happened, come back. They came back from 1-0 down as well. And then Sevilla smashed three goals in against Real Madrid in one half, and then see it out, 3-0 victory. So Atletico,
they could have won by more than three, man. I mean,
what does this mean for the La Liga title? At the beginning of the season, we did say probably more open than ever before.
Exactly. I think it just means it's confirmation of that fact. Because if you look at those top three contenders, and they've all lost a game now, and they've all kind of slipped up. I think Atletico's came against Celta Vigo a little bit earlier in the season, and then Sevilla's win last night obviously takes them within touching distance of top spot.
Well, it means
how well they'll sustain that.
If Alaves win tonight, they will go joint top with Real Madrid and Barcelona on 13 points.
There we go.
It's funny thing is obviously both of them lost first time since early 2015 that's happened. They both lost on the same game week. It's the first time since 2005 Barcelona conceded two goals within a minute of each other. That last time was against Valencia when David Villa went to town. The humiliation was bigger for Barcelona, right? Because they lost the 20th place team. They took the lead and they kind of, in a Mourinho-esque kind of fashion, just sort of got a bit too comfortable. It's a wonderful goal from Coutinho to take the lead, but really, really good. They got a bit too comfortable with themselves. Didn't really have the tactical discipline. The shape was a bit wrong because he didn't have Jordi Alba on the left. He had Vermaelen left back, and that was just a stupid idea. And they got it done by two long balls. Simple as that, really. The first goal was shocking from Vermaelen defending. The second goal, Piqué literally kicked the ball to the opposite striker.
Piqué has been coming under fire.
Shaved his beard. He's been terrible.
Samson.
Literally, him and Messi shaved their beards before the weekend's game against Girona. They drew that game.
They both scored in that one.
Yeah,
but I got a bit of stick because I focused on the fact they'd shaved their beard and they're not won, but then people correctly pointed out that both of them had scored.
Yeah, so. But then both of them hadn't really played that well. They both scored, but they didn't really play too well. And then against this week, they're still beardless and they lost again. So
beardless and pointless.
I mean, yeah, look, Barcelona, the humiliation was definitely bigger for them, but the solutions are obvious, right? First off, you play Jordi Alba. If you don't play Jordi Alba, you play Juan Miranda, natural left back. Secondly, you know, just move Messi centrally. This is what I've been saying all summer. I figured they wouldn't play 4-3-3 in this way because it exposes the right flank because Messi doesn't play on the right. That stretches out the midfield and then the whole system is gone. Move Messi centrally into 4-3-1, 4-3-3 false line, whatever it is, you'll be fine. For Real Madrid, the problem is, I think, bigger. The humiliation isn't too bad. They've only won one of the last seven La Liga games at Sevilla anyway, right? They always tend to struggle there. What was problematic was the way in which they lost. It wasn't close. Never once did Real Madrid look like they were actually going to turn it around or even come close to coping with Sevilla. Sevilla should have won by more than three goals. They had so many chances on the break in the second half. What's worrying is that was Real Madrid's first choice team, except for Nacho, a right back. That was basically their best team that they can put out this season, and they look rubbish. They really look bad at coping with the break. And this is the thing, Toni Kroos. Everyone's always argued with me about Toni Kroos. But Toni Kroos can't defend transitions. He's a problem defensively, and Casemiro also can't defend transitions. He's a problem position. He's a great recovery tackler, but his positional sense is awful. So Modric has been the guy covering for both of them all his time there, and he's done it brilliantly because he's been amazing. But even he now is taking it, like Godin, he's 33, he's taking a bit longer to recover from the World Cup than expected. He'll come good, he's phenomenal, he's not finished.
He's the best.
He is literally the best, according to people. So he'll come good, it's not like a long-term problem, but it's an issue that Madrid are going to have. How do you solidify yourself in transition when basically your first choice 11 can't defend transitions?
Shall I tell you who are quite good in transition as well?
Go on then.
Is Atletico Madrid. Who they have. Who will sit back and obviously defend as they do and then slice teams apart.
They had a rough start,
Yeah, but this is what I mean.
As always, Diego Simeone's teams, as always, struggle with actually being a recognised favourite. Like, they don't understand how to play. But then they've lost these games, and now they're not. Now suddenly everyone's like, oh, Atletico, they're not going to do it this year. Now suddenly they're like, oh, okay. Now
this is the thing, right? Because I picked Atletico Madrid out to win the league this season, and then when they started with like a defeat and a couple of draws, I was like, oh.
I think the first game was the Valencia draw. Yeah. So the defeat came a little bit.
So it was a bit like, oh, God, I shouldn't have said that early. But now, if they beat Real Madrid, they leapfrog them, going to 14 points. And obviously, Barcelona are against Bilbao this weekend. Yeah, Athletic Club. So,
they're not playing too well right now either, to be honest.
Iñaki Williams, I saw a really good stat about him. His last 11 goals have been away from
home. Yeah, he doesn't score. Although that's not fair entirely, because he should have scored against Real Madrid, but Iker Muniain just toe-poked the ball off him and he should have been his goal.
But anyway, so if Iñaki Williams channels his away goal-scoring form, beat Barcelona, Atletico Madrid win the derby, which is the first one without Ronaldo, since Ronaldo played, since April 2013, he'd actually played in 20 consecutive ones.
You know what's interesting about that is, so often Real Madrid beat Atletico Madrid because Cristiano Ronaldo.
Yeah.
And I mean, often, obviously, you always say, oh, well, he scored a goal. Of course he did. But there were many games where Real Madrid, like, they could win the game without Cristiano. And him was there just being, was like, it was helping get over it. Atletico Madrid was one game where it always looked like, oh, God, what the hell are we going to do? Then he would show up and score.
That hat trick.
He loved playing Atletico Madrid. He was excellent against them. Interestingly, Valencia was one of the teams he always struggled against. And he got sent off in the Champions League against them, which was funny. But Sevilla and Atletico Madrid were two teams that Cristiano crucified. He loved playing against them. And it was really, really interesting that they struggled against Sevilla hugely. They always lose there, but they struggled without Cristiano. And then now they're going to play Atletico Madrid, and he always killed Atletico. So it's going to be really interesting to see how Madrid deal with Atletico. Because now Atletico got the tails up. Madrid are like, what the hell's going on?
Costa Griezmann is one of the best strike forces.
And Ramos is, and I've been saying this for a long time, as a pure defender, he's not really played well for a long time now. Not consistently. And he was shocking against, I mean, Marcelo caught a lot of flak, because he always does, but he picked up an injury. But Ramos was equally bad.
Well, in the Super Cup, the Costa Ramos sort of tussles were great.
Costa made mincemeat out of him. Varane is going to have the game of his life to keep Costa under control, because Ramos is not going to be able to handle
him. And with Atletico Madrid, it's not directly relevant to their form, but just they signed Angel Correa, who's their new number 10. They signed him to a new deal. To me, Atletico Madrid look the best place, if we're talking about long term challenges for the title as well.
They
look the best place to, if they did perform well this season, to then sustain it.
Well, sustaining is always tricky with Atletico. Let's let them win first. I mean, because
They've tied all these deals down.
Again, on paper, yes, but with Atletico, it's always about the mental issue. Can they cope mentally with being favourites? That they've never done that well. And now I think they almost had to start poorly to get going this season almost. So let's see. I think they'll do very well.
So Real Madrid, Atletico.
I think Atletico will win.
Will, do you have any thoughts on it?
Yeah, I think narrow Atletico win, but I can see Oblak having a very, very good game. Yeah. As he tends to do against Real Madrid.
As he tends to do against every team in the world.
Yeah, he's a bit of a goalie. A bit of a good goalie, that one.
This is the final word we're going to finish on now. I think the award ceremony for the FIFA Best Awards is obviously at Squawker. We did a piece on it being the worst awards for quite a while. One of the things was the goalkeeper. Thibaut Courtois, named the best goalkeeper.
Well, the thing there is, because the best goalkeeper is voted on by a panel of goalkeepers and strikers, so actual football experts, and then the FIFA 11 is voted for by other players, current players, and it's just like...
This is the point of it, isn't it?
Yeah.
There were so many decisions that baffled a lot of people.
Yeah.
The goalkeeper, obviously, as we said, Thibaut Courtois got the best. David De Gea was in the FIFA World 11. Mm. If you were going to choose one goalkeeper to be in your World 11, and I just want the answer of the team, who would you choose out of those two based on the last season?
It's Oblak was the best goalkeeper last season, but of those two, De Gea.
I'd have De Gea in my team if I was picking a lineup, but you can see why Courtois won it, because De Gea had a really bad World Cup, Courtois had a really good one.
So
I've not really got a massive issue.
The panel obviously valued the World Cup very high, whereas the players...
Well, again, maybe that's the problem with it. The criteria is not defined.
I think, there's always a suspicion that FIFA will sort of trump up achievements and feats
made during World Cups because that's their sort of flagship competition. Yeah. And Champions League belongs to UEFA.
Yeah, I mean, the World Player of the Year, for years, the World Player of the Year award would always go to the best player from the World Cup winning side. It was just, that was just
Modric, the first ever player to win FIFA World Player of the Year, Golden Ball at the World Cup, and UEFA Player of the Year. And to sort of counterpoint that, he was the only player to win Golden Ball and UEFA Men's Player of the Year since Ronaldo in 1998.
That's really surprising, but well earned, I think. He was really phenomenal, and I think as much as obviously the idea of individual awards in a team sport is ludicrous, I think when you look at the way that they award the best, it's obviously a combination of individual quality and then how big of an influence you have on your team.
It seems to me, relative to team success, because it is team sport.
And I think Modric, you look at the influence he's had on Real Madrid, not just last year, but last three, four years, been phenomenal. And then at Croatia, you know, it was incredible. Although I do think it's quite funny that, as I pointed out, there was no representation for Man City players. I mean, De Bruyne got like 3.4% of the votes.
Well, this is the thing.
And what was interesting is, honestly, they both had... Modric had a better... De Bruyne had a better season, league season, club season than Modric did. I know Modric won the Champions League, but De Bruyne was phenomenal. And at the World Cup, honestly, they were about as good as each other. They were both really, really good. So they played France, and then both of them were terrible against France. And it was just... It's like...
Well, this is the thing. It's like, you know, again, the other contradiction that I thought stood out the most was Mbappe being in the World 11, the youngest ever player to be in the World 11, another record from him. But Salah was in the top three, and they were pretty much going for the same spot in that team. So does that just... Was this the year... Because usually there's quite a lot of... It's consistent. Yeah. Was this the year where...
But it's so... The process is so higgledy-piggledy. I had no idea I was going to use that word when there I flew into that sentence.
FIFA, get rid of your higgledy-piggledy awards.
Yeah, it's part fan vote, part captains, coaches, journalists. Yeah. So there's no one really you can point the finger of blame at.
No.
If it's not incoherent, it's incoherent because there's so many sort of...
It's not just that they're...
Yeah, it depends on so many different factors.
Yeah, there's loads of different voting groups, which is weird in the first place. And the voting criteria themselves are not really clearly explained. And I think that... really bears itself out in the FIFA 11, which nearly always is just the most popular players. It's never like what the World 11 should be. It's just, okay, these are the most famous players. And, you know, and that's the problem. I mean, I wrote the article about the best being the worst, and there is so much wrong. Like, why is Eden Hazard a quote-unquote midfielder?
Yeah. Well, the thing is, I'd use to defend that is when Ronaldo used to play right midfield for Man United when he first broke through. If you look at the FIFA Pro 11s that he was included in, he was a midfielder.
That's still stupid.
I know it's still stupid, but I'm saying people are now using it to.
At least it's consistently stupid.
It's consistently stupid.
Yeah. Well, that's what I think.
Danny Alves was in the World 11 for.
So this is what I quickly wanted to run through was I've picked out the four I think most surprising results of it. So we'll start with the Puskás Award winner. James Milner didn't agree, but should Mohamed Salah's goal have won the Puskas?
No, it was.
Who would you do? Who would you? Who
Cristiano
would,
Ronaldo, the picture perfect bicycle kick goal.
Will,
Gareth Bale. I don't want to go into this debate again.
That could be a podcast in itself on the aesthetics of a bicycle kick. But the second choice was, as Mo touched on, there was Dani Alves at right back in the World 11.
Perplexing. He's not.
No.
He's
and been, then who would you put instead?
Oh, Kimmich. No, Carvajal.
But I mean, Kyle Walker, I think.
Yes. Or Ramos at right back, and then got in central defence. Yeah.
I think Kyle Walker.
And that would have been Man City representation.
Yeah, exactly. Well, so. Because right back is odd in the sense that there's three sort of really good ones. Dani Alves is obviously one of the best right backs ever, but he didn't have one of the best seasons ever last season.
I think it's because he had a bit of a reign as best right back in the world, and it was. Him and Lahm, you could go to and say, oh, one of them, because they've got such legendary status.
Everyone loves him. He's such a lovely
guy. Even Idris Elba ropes him into the farcical comedy attempt.
Yeah, because he's a funny guy.
And then another one that I touched on, should Mbappe have been in that World 11?
Yeah, because I kind of think he should have been player of the tournament in the World Cup. I think they just gave it to Modric because they could give Mbappe the young player one. Yeah. And it was a way of appeasing both sides.
So Salah not in front three, after which you remind me often, becoming the first player to score 32 goals in a 38-game Premier League season.
I would say. No, it's tricky. I think because I kind of agree with weighting it in favour of World Cup achievements.
So Mbappe.
But I mean, Salah's like historic. That's historic. I think.
No, I would. I mean, it's historic, mate. First teenage World Cup goal. First teenage World Cup final goal.
Right, but that's just one moment. Like Salah's historic achievement is sustained over.
Well, you don't have to sell me on my
actually, Salah. Sorry, right, Salah.
There you go. I knew I could get it.
You have to sell me on Mohamed Salah, man. Quinn, you know this. I love that guy.
So, Mo, quickly, would you have had in that front three? Actually, I won't say Mbappe or Salah. Who would you have had in your front three?
Cristiano Ronaldo, Lionel Messi, and Antoine Griezmann.
There you go. Gets rid of them both. I think Antoine Griezmann has been unfairly represented in all of these awards.
He would be the first to say so himself as well, wouldn't he?
And that's probably why, because he's rubbing people up the wrong way. And
then, he really is, isn't he?
And then finally, does Messi just being fifth ruin it all?
I mean, yeah.
I don't know how this happens as well, because 25% of the vote is fan voted.
That just means that journos didn't vote for Messi, basically, and neither did players and coaches.
It's all transparent, that, as well.
I do want to own up, to finish off one thing. I thought I was doing some groundbreaking journalism about how Neymar hadn't received a single vote from any of the coaches and realised that you could only vote for the top 10, and he wasn't in it.
No, top 10. I thought...
Which is odd, because he came third last year, anyway.
That's why you shouldn't move to PSG, but, you know, that's really him.
That's another podcast. And I think in terms of that, I think we do have to finish up the Carabao Cup, Premier League preview, Puskas. We've done it all, and I think we have to end it there. So, Will, thank you for coming on.
Thank you for having me.
And Mo, thank you for coming on.
Justice for Messi.
Justice for Messi. And we'll speak to you next time on the Squawker Talker. Take care.